Hello, everyone. Welcome, and thank you for coming out on this freezing night. I'm in denial when summer is over. I say, well, the weather's still nice. It's still nice. It's still nice. And then this happens, and it's like, okay, it really is winter now.
Yeah.
Can't deny it anymore. But we have to keep warm, and we have to stay together. That's the only way we can get through the geological or geographical winter, and also the political winter, which many of us have already been experiencing and may get worse. I'm really delighted to be here, and I'm thrilled that we're together to welcome Muhammad to Chicago. I want to say that this event is organized by American Friends Service Committee, which does tremendous work. Jennifer and her colleagues do amazing work. We were here just a week ago, just downstairs, celebrating the work that they do, that JVP does, and that Palestine Legal does. So, it's a tremendously strong community here for Palestine. And to co-sponsor it, along with Haymarket Books, and Haymarket published Muhammad's book, Shell Shocked, which is really an incredible way to educate people about what's happening in Gaza, and my book. And just a few weeks ago, we were in Hyde Park celebrating Haymarket Books' 15th anniversary. And, Haymarket is another incredible Chicago institution and resource, and I'm very proud that they're in this city. And they publish so many amazing books. They're at the back, the table at the back. Make sure you pick up all your holiday gifts from the table at the back. But also, one thing I learned at that celebration a few weeks ago, that the very first title of the more than 500 books that Haymarket Books has published now, the very first title was on Palestine. So Haymarket has had, from its very inception, a very deep commitment to educating people about Palestine. Jennifer mentioned that the Electronic Intifada, one of the things I'm very proud of is the amount of original reporting that we're publishing by journalists in Gaza, many of them young journalists. They're absolutely brilliant. And this is completely independent journalism, and it's some of the best journalism you're going to read on Gaza, coming out of Gaza and written by Palestinians in Gaza. So if you want to get that, if you're not already on our email list, I would love for you to sign up. I'm going to pass this around, and we'll add you to our daily newsletter, and we'll also use this to send you information about the Gaza Unlocked campaign, which we're going to hear more about tonight. So I'm just going to pass this around. Benjamin, if you can pass this on. Muhammad Omar, I was in Chicago before. When I was talking to him the other day, I said, oh, how long has it been? It's been 2 years since you were here. He said, what do you mean? It was 2009. I couldn't believe it. It seems like yesterday. And since 2009, so much has happened in this country, in Palestine, in Gaza. Muhammad was in Gaza during the war of 2014 and was absolutely, I say this with no exaggeration, the most important source of information for me. And one of the very few that I felt completely confident about in terms of knowing exactly what's happening and continuing that work under the most horrific circumstances. Muhammad was on Worldview today with Jerome McDonnell. And if you haven't heard that interview, or if you know people who you want to share it with, it's on the WBEZ website. And one thing he said today, which I really identified with, on the radio, he said, "I never wanted to be a journalist." And nor did I. But as he said, in something he wrote a few years ago, in 2008, which is actually on the Electronic Intifada, he said, "Life forced me from an early age to face injustice and oppression. I witnessed the killing of innocents and the demolition of houses in Rafah. And so, aged 17, I felt I had to become a journalist. Initially, I could do little more than observe. I had no camera, no computer, only a small notebook in which I wrote down what was happening. I would write articles and keep them as records for myself. That notebook lies buried beneath the rubble of our demolished house." One day in March 2003, I returned home to the debris of what had been my home, ravaged by Israeli bulldozers. They were making room for Israel's iron wall dividing Gaza from Egypt. Everything material was destroyed in that demolition. The massive military bulldozers inhaled our two-story house, swallowed our books, furniture, clothes, and all the everyday objects precious to our family. Two things remained: memory and hope. Memory of the past and hope for the future. Hamad talks about the fact that most of his brothers have been injured during Israeli invasions, and one lost his life. And through all of this, Muhammad continued to reach out to the world, becoming a journalist and doing tremendous work that continues to this day, being published in the New York Times, Al Jazeera, Middle East Eye, and many, many others. And it's a tremendously exciting that the last stop on what has been a tremendously successful national tour is here in Chicago, which I hope you'll consider to be one of your homes. And so please join me in welcoming Muhammad Omar.
Shukran, ya Ali. Hello, Chicago.
Hello.
It's real excitement to be here, actually. I have always, whenever I want to make the New Yorkers really upset, I tell them Chicago is my favorite city in the U.S. And I mean it. So, whenever I come to the United States to speak in this country, I actually find it a bit difficult to start, where to start talking about Gaza. Gaza is a bit tough topic. And for that reason, I have decided I actually wanted to take all of us for 30 minutes a visit to Gaza. Now, don't dream it's going to happen reality, okay? But, well, we'll take you for 30 minutes to Gaza. So, the first thing we will be going is through the borderline with Egypt and Israel. So there are two options. How many of you think that you can cross via Egypt, and how many of you can cross via Israel? I mean, can we see how many people think that you can cross via Egypt? Raise your hands if you leave via Egypt. So it's about 4 or 5. And via Israel? What about the rest?
You can't cross.
You can't cross. That's the story, unfortunately. So Gaza is... Just to envision the Gaza Strip, I brought you something to look at the map here of New York, so you can just try to visualize what Gaza is really on the map. We are talking about an area of 23 miles, so you can cross from the southern part of the Gaza Strip to the northern part of the Gaza Strip within 1 hour, actually. Gaza has always been referred to in the international media as an open prison. It is an open prison. The Strip, because it takes the shape of a strip. And Gaza has been living under most grim situation. Just to give you a little bit of history about where Palestine was before Israel was created, and I'm sure many of you know about that map, which I'll show in a minute. This map actually shows you Palestine before 46 and right after Israel was established. You are looking at the green side where the Palestinian lands. And when Israel was started in 47, 49 to 67, and then this is what's left basically in the year 2000. And that's 16 years. So imagine 16 years ago, now we are talking a lot of buffer zones that are created across the Gaza Strip. And a lot of restricted areas for both fishermen and farmers, which I would like to talk about. Of course, refugees' problem is not new. It started from 94, but Gaza has also been controlled by the British mandate, the Egyptian rule, and the Israeli occupation. I have a lot of respect for a group like the Quakers who came to the Gaza Strip to help the United Nations in easing the situation of the Gazans. They are the ones who started to empower volunteerism among youth and people, and now they are doing an amazing job among those youth across the Gaza Strip. Just to remind you a few facts before we start this trip, Gaza is 2 million inhabitants. It's no longer 1.5 as we see in most of media outlets. It's 2 million people. Out of the 2 million people, 69 of them are living, basically they are under the age of 18 years old. We are talking about children and youth. And 1.2 million of the population suffer continuous traumatic stress disorder. I refrain to use the term post because one of the doctors that I've seen in Seattle said this can't be post because this is a continuous trauma. What I have seen in Gaza is a continuous trauma which continues for years. So Gaza has always been an open prison. We are talking about the southern part of the Gaza Strip here. If we see, that's the wall that divides Egypt and the Gaza Strip. If you see to the other side of the photo or the beautiful houses, there used to be exactly the same houses on the other side in the Palestinian side when Israel destroyed these houses to create the Iron Wall, which Ali caught me by surprise of one of the first articles I have written talking about this Iron Wall. Now, you will be very surprised to know that none of these houses that you see on the Egyptian side exist. Because when Sisi took over, he decided he wanted to create something called the buffer zone by destroying at least 1,600 Egyptian homes. So this area is basically becoming now the new buffer zone in the border with Gaza. So we start our trip. We go into Gaza. There are two ways to get into the Gaza Strip. One is Rafah crossing, and the other one is via the northern part of the Gaza Strip, Israel. It is crossing. You may think that I'm American, I can get into the side of the Gaza Strip or anywhere I want with my passport. I would tell you, try again, this is not possible. So our way to get into the Gaza Strip would be actually the southern part of the Gaza Strip, and that is Rafah refugee camp. So we will go to Rafah. There will be a number of stops that we would like to stop, so something to take home. And the first thing I'd like you to see is the tunnels. The tunnels which are operating underneath the borderline between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. These tunnels were actually the lifeline of the population of the Gaza Strip. We are talking about an entire population that relied on these tunnels for many years to survive. And I tell you why, because in 2008, the Israeli Knesset issued a ban list of items, about 81 items, that the Israelis decided they don't want to allow into the Gaza Strip. Some of these items include tea, coffee, pencils, coriander to make falafel, shoelace, ketchup, and many other items which were in a ban list. Nobody knows why these items were in a ban list by Israel, so those young people, their job is to bring food and medical supplies and all these materials to bring to the Gaza Strip. We're talking about 950 tunnels that used to operate in the Gaza Strip. And now there is only 5 because most of these tunnels have been either bombed by Israeli F-16s or drowned by the Egyptian military through sewage water as here. Hundreds of young people who died as a result of all these difficult conditions, unfortunately. And you know, most of those people who die are basically young people. We will have four more stops with the Gaza border. We will be going to a school, we will go to a hospital, and we will go to a farm, and we will stop at the very end with the home of Shijaiya in the east of Gaza. I'm sure all of us know about Shijaiya. Shijaiya, the area that was heavily bombed during the 2014-51 day assault. The schools in Gaza. It puzzled me really going to one of the areas in Gaza City and finding this teacher who actually had lost two of his legs and his arm. And all I find that he is ironing his shirt and he says, I'm going to go down to school after 2 weeks of my injury. I'm going to be there in the middle of the students. He wants to continue life. And I was very surprised to see that the teacher did manage to go to the school because he valued the importance of the education. Grandmothers in Palestine continue to insist that education is the only way to beat the occupation. The teacher is here, and he went all the way from a place where he lost his two legs and arm into a classroom. And when you ask him what motivates you, he says, sir, we teach life, sir. We are Palestinians. We teach life. We're going to continue to teach our children to love and not to hate. We are going to teach our children who lost their homes. And by the way, all these kids in this classroom in the east of Gaza City, some of them had lost family members and some had lost homes. I think the majority of them are actually became homeless because they live in an area which was completely destroyed. This is an example of resilience that you can find in Gaza, which can't be really described in any words. Just the power of people who continue to send their kids to schools despite of all the odd realities and despite of all the situation. You would find the water leaking in a terrible winter day, and people will still insist that they want to send their kids to schools. That's something, you know, which is amazing. The same thing with the second stop, we will see the healthcare crisis in the Gaza Strip. I have a great respect, in fact, for all the health workers and the ambulance crews in the Gaza Strip. They work extremely hard under the most difficult situation. When Israel imposed the siege for the 10th year, and they continue to go on and with their work with some of the most basic and minimum supplies. We are talking about shortages of electricity. We are talking about shortages of medical supplies here. I was driving just behind this ambulance in Gaza City when it was bombed, and you will be very surprised to see, in this case, there are people who were injured twice. They were evacuated by ambulance crews, and then the ambulance was attacked by tank shells, so they were injured two times. But there are people who were injured three times. Because the moment they were taken to that hospital, then they were taken into Al-Aqsa Hospital, and the hospital itself was bombed. So imagine somebody who's injured in one day three times. The same situation for people who went to seek refuge inside UN schools. You know, whenever I talk about the shortages of medical supplies, my job is to ask all these hard questions for officials, whether they are Hamas, Fatah, Palestinian Authority, Jordan, Egypt, or Israel. And I found a lady who had to go for medical treatment, and she needs medication that costs her $800. I was very surprised that nowhere to get this money, and she said, she said to me that the ministry have got it. So I went to the deputy minister and I said, sir, I think you have got this medication, but you only select who to give it to. He challenged me. He took me inside this stock of Shifa Hospital, and I was really quite shocked to see how much they are deceiving people by telling them we are all set, we have got all the medications, but in fact the stocks are on near empty. I could not find any explanation of why some of the medications are kept for months on the borderline of Gaza and they are allowed only 2 to 3 weeks before the expiry date. So by the time people get it in their hands, they have about 10 days left of expiry. The situation in Gaza continues, the trauma continues. Gaza families live under constant pressure and trauma. We are talking also, not only about that, but during the war, the outages of electricity, 12 to 18 hours of power cuts per day. That's in the best scenario. And so here I want to ask a question. If you don't have electricity, and Gaza, I can tell you, we don't have wood, and you want to cook a meal, what are you going to do? Can anybody tell me what are the options that are available there? Imagine yourself in a situation where you want to cook and you need fire, there is no wood.
Kerosene.
What is that?
Kerosene.
Well, what are you going to use it with? You need fire. You cannot just have kerosene water and then blowing it like that. Right? You need wood.
You mean
gas cylinders?
Yeah, yes.
Natural gas. Okay, the cooking gas. So that's the situation here. We're talking about people who are staying for at least 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks to fill a gas cylinder because they can't fill a gas cylinder in Gaza. That's a very unfortunate situation. People stay here for days, weeks, and if they are not lucky, it could be months. And by the way, this crisis is now in Gaza, that the shortages of cooking gas is something which just stops life across the Gaza Strip. To take the positive side, you would be very surprised to know that Gaza produced the most delicious strawberries. Gaza produced delicious strawberries, much nicer than the one you get in Chicago, I can assure you that. And, you know, until recently, just a few days ago, the Israelis were able to allow some trucks to get outside of the Gaza Strip. But that is nothing compared to what it used to be before the siege was put into place before 2005. You see about over 9,000 trucks were able to get outside in one season of a strawberry. While in 2014, 228 trucks. That's a big comparison. But who suffers in this? It's the poor farmers who are continue to suffer constantly because they have to pay the wages of their workers and they have to pay for the services and they have to get all the materials that they need. But unfortunately, most of them end up in jail because they don't deliver any of the promises that to their workers and service providers. But it can be a much worse situation, actually. When your strawberries are nicely packed, getting ready to go to Europe, and they spend a few days at the Israeli crossings, they become, you know, under the sun, of course. And then by the time they get to Amsterdam in the Netherlands, where they are sold, then they return them on your own expense as a farmer. And that happened quite often in Gaza. You know, being a homeless in Gaza is never it's something of a lot of a trauma that comes with it. I want you to look at this photo of that bulldozer and those people. And I want you to try to imagine what that could be. Can anybody guess what that could be? Somebody told me it's a picnic. What is that? No, this one.
It's earth moving
equipment. Mm-hmm. Can anybody give a caption to that photograph? No.
Moving.
There are thousands behind him. Behind this truck, there are thousands of people.
Were they trying to demolish the house?
Bravo, Sarah. Yeah, that's the situation. This is evacuation. People evacuate from their homes. This massive number of people, they evacuate only by one phone call from an Israeli officer say, evacuate your house, we're going to bomb it. And this is what happened in this situation, in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. People have nowhere else to go. Imagine if you receive a phone call and then everybody doesn't know where to go. Because it's the psychological war that Israel started during the war that makes people have nowhere else to run to. Well, many of them ran into the UN schools, and you would be very surprised that the UN schools were also bombed during the war. The United Nations have told the Israelis, according to the spokesman of the UNRWA, 15 times of all these places where there are refugees and homeless families. So they say, don't bomb these areas. But Israel did not bomb all the areas except these specific places which were hit and the people were injured. People get back to their homes, that's what they find. Just massive destruction caused to their homes. And I can tell you, none of the houses that have been completely destroyed have been built. It's only some home repairs that are happening, and not only that. Most of the infrastructure of Gaza is still struggling. But I also have a great respect for people like Father Manuel Musallam and the churches in Gaza. During this war, they were the only ones who opened the door for people to come in, providing the children with milk, diapers, and food. The church was the place where people can run into, but a place, but that church also was bombed, in fact, in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Sorry, in the Gaza, in the eastern part of Gaza City. But then there is so much stories of resilience and dignity in Gaza, which you don't find really anywhere else. I have worked in many other places, reported in war zones, and the stories of resilience are just amazing. You go to this family, the whole area is turned into pieces. They know that the more they dig under the ground, all these bodies that are still missing of human beings that belongs to these families, they don't know what happened to them. I was there because I happened to know this old lady, and she said, wait, you're coming from the south. You're a guest. She lost the house at that moment, and then she said, let me dig down underneath the ruin of the house because I want to find the tea bags. We have to make you some tea before you go. That's a woman who lost her house and a family member. These type of stories of resilience, that what makes the people of Gaza really strong and go forward. Nobody is going to go to starve in Gaza because there is this social fabric within the society that, you know, people just share whatever they have got, even if it's a loaf of a bread and nothing else. In Gaza, you will find a lot of stories of people who wanted to continue life and fly kites across the borderline, but also play parkour on the ruins of their demolished homes and the schools. And that's just the freedom for the people in Gaza. But also, you find people who are sharing all types of things across the Gaza Strip, even in demolished houses and areas like that. Well, this is not the roof, by the way. This is he did not make the roof, remove that roof of the car on purpose, but that's basically the war. So I guess I'll just try to conclude here and take more questions, but what I want you to take from here is to share these stories of resilience of daily life in Gaza, to urge your elected officials to end the blockade on the Gaza Strip, and that is the blockade is illegal according to international law, but not Israel. The United Nations have always called on ending the blockade in Gaza, and to join us in the Gaza Unlocked campaign. That's a hashtag, Gaza Unlocked. So anybody who's on Twitter and Facebook, please join us. And then there will be another book which I'm writing called On the Pleasures of Living in Gaza. So, and I mean that, it's not a sarcastic title. It's actually, there is so much pleasure in Gaza that we need to bring to the outside world and to tell about the daily life in Gaza. It's not only misery in Gaza, but there is life. There are people who love life. There are people who get married. There are people who go to schools, and there are people who have hope. You would be very surprised to see the level of students who continue day and night to apply for scholarships outside. but then they never get the chance to get outside. I know a lot of students who got the Fulbright scholarship, but they could not leave the Gaza Strip because neither Israel nor Egypt would allow them to go outside to continue education. Well, in the situation of Egypt, it would cost you at least $6,000 to bribe the troops in order to cross outside of the Gaza Strip. So I just learned about Gaza. That's a campaign which I established, and I really hope that you can take that on, and I'm more than happy to start taking any questions from you guys. Thank you.
So I want to just to kick off the discussion with a couple of questions. First of all, thank you for the presentation and for sharing these images, which brought back memories of my only visit to Gaza so far. I hope it will only be the first visit, but who knows when I'll be able to go by balloon or by tunnel or by high-speed bullet train or, I don't know, maybe by rocket. But somehow I hope to go back to Gaza. But two questions I'm going to ask you to start things off. One is, when I was listening to you, I was thinking about when I was in Gaza, the most striking thing for me and the thing that I think about every day was the young people I met, who are in fact the majority of the population in Gaza, and the high level of their education and their ambition was the most striking thing. And so I wanted to ask you, you talked about the hope and the resilience. Where does that come from? Is it still there after 2014 with so little reconstruction?
Thank you, Ali. Well, you know, no doubt 2014 war was the worst war that hit Gaza. Really, this war really, really, really just destroyed Gaza, you know. It destroyed a lot of the spirits that we had. It destroyed a lot of private sector and businesses. We are talking about thousands of workshops that used to operate across the borderline with Israel and the borderline in the southern bar of Gaza, and they were simply bombed, you know. So we are talking about massive destruction, people who lost their jobs, they lost hope, and the closure of the Rafah crossing, all these fences, and the shooting at the fishermen constantly. So there is no, we can't deny that. But the hope is still there. And I'm amazed, really, how people pick that. It's just they continue to survive from day to day. Despite the fact that you don't have electricity, you find people just finding a small means in order to get together and make life. You have shortages of medical supplies. You find people who are creative and want to create something out of nothing. And, you know, this is where the resilience really is. And, you know, I can't claim that, you know, people are not emotionally disturbed, the least to say, with what is happening in Gaza. But the resilience is there. Otherwise, we can't find any explanation of how people who lose hope of applying for another scholarship and then they don't get outside and then they continue again and again and again. It's just, this is the type of persistence which you have among the people of Gaza, which is very high, much higher than anybody can imagine. And we have seen that throughout. Like, you would find people who would be spending 20 hours waiting at the Rafah crossing to cross. They will come the next day, and the day after, and the day after, and the day after, and they will continue like that for years. Maybe it's in the genes of the people, I don't know. I mean, I find it, and it's. I didn't find this anywhere else. People usually just give up from the first, the second trial, and then they just go home. But in Gaza, people continue to push because they want to make a headway. And you know, I often get from American audiences the issue of why rockets are being fired from Gaza. So I went actually to the northern bar of Gaza, and I wanted to ask one of those guys who fire these rockets. I said to this gentleman, come and tell me, what's that? And he said, well, really? You don't understand why we do that? I said, I do understand, but Americans don't. So give me an answer that I can tell them. He was masked. Believe it or not, he put a California accent on that you cannot tell he would be American or a Palestinian. I was very shocked, to be honest. Maybe he's like in his early 20s. He said, I went to San Diego University. And I was like, really? He said, yeah. And I'm firing rockets today at the Israelis because that's my only way to scream to the world that we are still alive here. I won the Fulbright scholarship for the second time. I couldn't leave. And the moment they let me go to San Diego, I'll stop, obviously. So this is the type of people who are really firing rockets. Do they want to hurt the Israelis? No. They're just desperate. They want to get outside. They want to be able to live. People want to continue to survive. People want to continue to export and import. You know, in Gaza, there is this factory which I discovered that makes all these beauty materials and cosmetics and shampoos and perfumes. And they used before the siege to export to Lebanon, to Syria, to all these places around the world. But not anymore. But they still continue because the man believes that there will be one day that he's going to be able to export the materials. So resilience is there, the hope is there, and you know, because people have got no hope really in the international community, they just rely on themselves, and they continue to rely on their inner resilience in order to face the challenges of life.
Thank you. And my second question, speaking of San Diego, you, as you've been traveling around the country, as Jennifer mentioned, you've been to see some of the beautiful sites in this country, the prisons in Arizona. And another thing you went to see is what I like to call the Obama Wall. I like to emphasize that because people think the wall on the U.S.-Mexico border is something that will come in the future, will be the wall that Trump will build, and not see that there's a wall already there. You posted of yourself a picture standing by this metal wall or fence, I don't know what to call it, and behind you there's someone sitting on a chair looking at the fence. I want you to talk about what's going on in that picture.
Yeah. Thank you. Very good question. You are a very faithful follower, actually.
Most.
I know that because during the war, it would be 3 a.m., 2 a.m., 4 a.m., and I would get all the retweets from Ali 24/7. I used to sleep maybe 3 hours every 24 hours, and Ali would be exactly doing the same. So please join me to appreciate the efforts of Ali Abu Namo. Well, going to this borderline, well, actually, it waked a lot of memories inside me, you know? I mean, Mexican border was the first experience for me. It reminded me, first of all, of my childhood going to school in the Rafah refugee camp. And wherever I go, I usually don't like to go the way like that. I like to go across the wall, against the wall, just all the way to the school. And as I go along, as a child, maybe 7 or 8, I used to find all these women across, just sitting against the wall, which Israel built, and trying to communicate messages to their relatives on the other side of the wall, on the Egyptian side. I don't know if we can, I'll just bring a photo so that it makes it, yeah. That wall. So walking by that, and I used to be really hired by some of these old women who wanted to go and pass the greetings. So hired to do what? To shout, actually. I was hired to shout, like one of the odd sentences you would be given, and then she would hire you for half an hour, and then you can buy a candy with whatever she gave you. And then you would say, did she get the pregnant? Yes, she got the pregnant. What did she say? How old? What? Okay. No, she's in the 7th month. So you have to pass that the message that she's in the 7th month. And then you say, okay, so what's the way of the baby in your stomach? And then you have to bring all these messages back and forth. All this story of who got married, who got divorced, who is with who, and all these stories that I was able to communicate, this is what I felt. But now, in a much better sense, those people are facing one another. At least this wall, as somebody, a journalist in Gaza, said to me, well, actually, the wall in the U.S. and Mexican border is a bit more human than ours. Because people communicate, you know. I mean, there was a man who was in the U.S. for 13 years, and his wife on the other end, he brought a chair, and she brought a chair, an umbrella, and both of them, they sit on that Sunday and chit-chat all along. Very heartbreaking to watch that. It's just the same stories that we see in Rafah until now, where people communicate because walls divide them, so they have to be separated. So it was a tough experience for me, but it wakened up a lot of memories, and it makes me wonder why these walls should be there. I mean, people can connect. And I want to remind you, in January 2008, if you don't remember, January 23rd, 2008, Palestinians knocked down the wall between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. During the 4 days of this opening, not one single rocket was fired from the Gaza Strip. You would be very surprised, because most of the people, they have their freedom. They can get outside of Gaza, they can get the materials they need, people can go. And you hear a lot of heartbreaking stories from Gaza, like somebody who said, it's my first time ever, that's a 13-year-old boy speaking to me, to drink a can of Coca-Cola alone on the Egyptian side, without a drone, without F-16s, and with just total freedom, only 10 minutes away from the border with Gaza.
So I'm going to help Mohammed take questions, but I do want to make a plug for social media that is enamored by Mohammed and also Ali. One of the things that we've been doing is sharing after his presentation. Audiences have been writing down something that they learned about Gaza and posting this on your own social media with the hashtag Gaza Unlocked. And also we've been taking pictures and sharing them on our social media. And they've been a way of communicating with people in Gaza about this tour as we've been going. So Mohammed has gotten a lot of messages from people that saying, oh, they know we make strawberries, yay, or, you know, just the various things that people have learned that, and as well about the resilience and the strength of the people in Gaza and how that inspires us here in this country. So we're very excited and hope that people, all of you today, will take a moment before you leave to fill something out and post it on your social media or help us with ours. So even today, Mohammed was at the McCormick Foundation and wanted to ask people in Gaza, well, what should I tell them? So immediately he was getting tweets from people in Gaza saying, you know, this is what I want people in Chicago to know. So for somebody who's organized a lot of speaking tours with people over the years, it's been a new experience to have this additional element of having direct contact with people on the ground. So it's a new age that we're in. So we'll take some questions here from the audience.
I was wondering if you've done this presentation in any portions of Israel or in Egypt or with Israelis to sort of begin this discussion between Israelis and people living in Gaza?
Yeah. No, well, you were asking actually if I did any of this presentation, whether in Israel or in Egypt. The short answer is no. I'm not allowed into Israel. and I'm not allowed to do speaking tours in Israel. As far as Egypt, I did a couple of those, and there was massive outrage and a lot of engagement from Egyptian public. So we have seen a lot of people who are so upset about this situation, and they want to change.
And have you, aside from going to Israel, have you had any chances to talk with Israelis outside or over social media?
The only Israelis that I know are the soldiers who point their guns at the children of Gaza and are those who try to order us what to do and what to wear and where to go and when to sleep and when not to get outside and to control our freedom as human beings. As far as I'm concerned, I have not met really with Israelis face to face who are not wearing uniform and have M16 guns.
How do you get out of Gaza, and if you go back, can you get out again? Can you get back in after a year here?
Usually it's very difficult to get outside of the Gaza Strip. I had to get outside actually to defend my PhD, and I wasn't allowed really to get outside of the Gaza Strip. It has taken months of a lot of lobbying and advocacy, and that includes advocacy on a minister and a state secretary level to get outside. I was fortunate because I had some people to help me and lobby for me, but remember that there are 2 million people in Gaza who have no one to lobby for them and no one to help them. Even with all my contacts, it has taken months to get outside of the Gaza Strip. And it's very difficult. It's a very tricky situation. You could be getting a visa to Europe to go for a conference, and then the visa will expire, and by the time they allow you, you don't have any visa anymore. So it's pretty much a frustration. We have another reason, that your passport expires, and then you are sending a renewal passport request to Ramallah, and you don't receive it on time. That's another situation. Or even worse, when you have, for instance, lined up to travel via Egypt, and then the authorities, they have too many people of cancer patients and people who need medical supplies before you, which I respect really. And I always say people who have medical needs and the students should be a priority before everybody else.
In your speech, I didn't really hear any critique of Israel or any bad feelings or anything like that, but I feel like, they've got to be there. I'm thinking, how do you deal with that human conflict of, being abused?
I'm a journalist, and my job is to share the information and to share the truth and to come with facts. And if there is only one thing that I'm biased to, it's justice, basically. And I'm not willing to spread hate here or critiques. What I'm trying to do is to report what I see and to tell you the story as it is. So I don't see any room why I should be being harsh or critiquing. I'm just giving people here the information, and they can make their mind and decide what they want to do with this information.
Has anything changed since UN recognized Palestine as a state in 2015?
Did they recognize Palestine, really? Well, you mean the General Assembly?
Yeah, General Assembly.
Okay. Well, nothing really. No. Nothing. No changes on the ground. It's just, it's actually more pressure. I did my PhD on TV programs, TV shows, of children TV shows. And one of the Palestinian TV shows actually was punished because it used to be receiving funding. The Palestinian Authority used to receive funds from the United States, the State Department, Ford Foundation. And after the recognition of Palestine, this TV show struggled that they cut the funding on it. So there is not much of real improvement in the ground, really, since the recognition, no.
What are relationships like between Muslims and Christians in Gaza? I mean, all I've heard is that Christians have left.
Okay, so you are asking about the relationship between Muslims and Christians in the Gaza Strip. Well, a lot of the Christians in the Gaza Strip, they have left. And you would be very surprised to know that the West have facilitated quite a lot of the departure of a Christian community in the Gaza Strip. And this was really one of the most difficult parts, because, you know, whenever there is a Palestinian Muslim who, with the name Muhammad or Ahmed or Mahmoud, want to travel to any country within Europe, they don't get a chance to travel, unfortunately. They don't get a chance to go outside of Gaza or get visa. So there was a lot of facilitation for the Christian community to migrate, actually, from the Gaza Strip into the outside. And we have seen that quite a lot more common. Now, there are about, I would say, 1,350 Christians who are living in Gaza. There is a lot of resilience. I can tell you, if you read the story of the blind man that I wrote for Middle East Eye, and I encourage you, if you want to be really inspired, just read this story about a man who, a Christian man, who takes his Muslim neighbor, who's blind, to the five prayers to the mosque, and he waits for him outside the mosque, each prayer. And during that time, they go outside, they sip coffee, and then they spend the night together. It's just a beautiful story of coexistence, because you don't actually see the difference between a Muslim and a Christian in Gaza. You can't tell the difference. In Shijaiya, you have a mosque, and next to it, there is a church. And they are perfectly fine and living together. You don't really see that difference, actually.
Christians, are they like Coptic Christians?
They're not Coptic. The ones in Gaza, they're not Coptic usually. There are many Catholics, there are many Orthodox, so it's a mix, but they are not Coptic. Coptic are usually more in Egypt, so they're not. It's a mix, and you know, they continue to struggle like everybody else. Now it's their period, actually. Now they struggle, actually, because now they want to go, they need to apply for exit permit outside of Gaza to celebrate Christmas in Bethlehem. So that's the period where they demand a lot of pressure. And most of them, they really don't want to get outside of Gaza because they own homes and they have, you know, their roots there, and they don't want to leave, even though they have been given a lot of privileges to return, to get outside, but under condition that they wouldn't return. So the only place they would want to go is basically Bethlehem or Ramallah or Jerusalem for the holidays and come back.
I was struck by the figure of the percentage of children. 69% are under the age of 18. Could you talk a little bit about what the education is like, what the schools are like now?
You'd be very surprised to see a lot. Very good question, thank you. You'd be very surprised to see a lot of these schools have 3 shifts per day, because the damage of these schools has forced the administration of the Ministry of Education to split the children into shifts, basically, across the Gaza Strip. So we find a lot of people who, you know, the education system, we are talking about 80% of the population who go to UN school. So that's UNRWA, the run school, and usually it's a very good quality education. You will be very surprised to go and speak English with those kids, and then you'll find really people who are able to communicate very good English language skills, and you know, so it's a very good system. The only part of the 20% of other schools that are still struggling is actually the ones that are run by government. So, and usually they are the ones who are run by the de facto authorities in Gaza. And those, they have a lot of shortages of everything, basically, including the teachers, who I admire very much, because most of them continue to go to schools despite the fact that they have not received their salaries for months. Or they maybe would be receiving 1,000 shekels, which is something like $250 per month, if they're lucky. The education system is pretty high. Quality is one of the best, definitely. As I speak to some UN officials, they compare it to other places and say this is really a good quality system in Gaza. And it's really quite good. And, you know, there is the determination of these families. 99.9% of the children, they have no option but to go to school. This is just like, education is holy for people. They just send their kids to school no matter what. Even on a day of rain or bad weather or even bombardment, you still find that children continue to go to schools. It's something that people are born in Gaza with the grandmothers all the time pushing their kids that they have to finish schools, they have to go to the university, they have to do college, they have to do masters. And that's why you have the highest percentage of people who have PhDs in Gaza, which is really quite surprising. You know, a lot of people in Gaza now, they have master degrees. And it's becoming actually quite common that, you know, you find almost all my friends that I deal with, they have master's degrees and they're looking for a PhD to continue their studies. You have made a very good list of wishful thinking in Gaza, which I'd like to see theaters and open playgrounds and safe places for the children to grow and to do that. None of that exists, unfortunately. It's the trauma is there. Nobody can hide it. The trauma is there. It's very tense. It's very high. And, you know, it's really something which you can see in a lot of the children in Gaza. You know, go to a school and ask the children to give them just some colors and empty paper and tell them to draw something. You would find that 87% of the children, they draw F-16s and ambulances and people are injured and killed. And that expressed the level of a trauma. As far as facilities to help people, I'm afraid there aren't much really to help people with trauma. There is the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. In my view, the program is really quite small and it doesn't really serve the needs of all the Gaza. I mean, many people are quite eager to talk that this is something that is helping. I think we need much more. We need to start integrating the psychology as part of the curriculum in the universities. And this is something much more important than any time before, because a lot of these generations, and especially children, they grow with the trauma, and you know, it continue to live with them. It continue to live with them. Nobody can do anything about it. You know, it's trauma is a trauma.
The similarities that you found in visiting the wall in the south. What were your impressions of your visit to Ferguson? Have you seen similarities with the conditions in Gaza?
You know, when I met with, it was of course more or less the same struggle, really. I met with a lot of the youth right-based groups who are working in Ferguson, and including the Youth Undoing Institutional Racism. That's a very good group of young people who are working to educate people and to undo the racism in this country. So I relate to a lot of stories. One of the things which really hit me most is the Mike Brown, his story, when I was told by a local black guy in Ferguson what happened and he was left to bleed. You see these situations constantly every single war in Gaza. Left to bleed, it's almost every day that you have a farmer who's left to bleed for hours or even days till they die. And in the war, a lot of these stories, I mean, Mike Brown, he has got a lot of attention in the media because he happened to be American, to his luck. As much as I'm very sad about this story, but I can relate to a lot of stories that I've seen as a journalist of people who were basically left bleeding and excessive use of power. And I think, Ali, we talked about that. If you remember, the youth who went to Shija'iyah every Friday, you know, to break the silence and, you know, to demonstrate and say we are fed up with the siege. They are the same story. People who were injured there and they were left to bleed for hours and hours and they could not be taken home. And you know, the excessive use of power by police, it's the same thing in Gaza, the excessive use of power and guns and militarism by the military in Israel. That's identical, same situation. Here it got more attention, got more word in the media, but in Gaza it didn't get much really attention.
I was wondering about what opportunities or lack thereof there are for Palestinians in Gaza to communicate with Palestinians in the West Bank.
I went to Columbia University in 2012, and I actually find it much easier to relate to American than somebody from the West Bank. Because for me, the people from the West Bank, even though I'm only about 30 minutes or 40 minutes away from them, but the fact that walls separated us, it made us totally different two countries and totally different, even though the same food, the same culture, but you know, it makes it difficult for you to relate. So we haven't been lucky really to connect with the people in the West Bank or Israel. Arab minority there, we haven't been able to go to these areas, and that is something, you know, it's people, you know, just, you know, never think of it, you know, it's just they are banned, they cannot meet. But nowadays, you know, thanks to social media, people are able to connect via Twitter and Facebook and, you know, try to do joint activities from Gaza and the West Bank, but they can't be there physically together because they're banned to go to these areas. Israel would not allow the youth to come to the West Bank or to go to Gaza. So that's a difficult situation, really.
Hamid, when I went to Gaza, I noticed that a lot of the older generation, or some of the older generation, understood or spoke Hebrew, and the younger people didn't. Can you explain why that's the case?
You would be very surprised to know my father, who's now 52, he speaks much better Hebrew than many Israelis. In fact, he used to teach Hebrew language, and he speaks it much better. He spent many years in jail, and you know, he learned the language and he mastered it. So a lot of the older generation, they are actually able to use the language, but not the young generation. Why? Because when the siege was put into place just in 2006, prior to that, people can go in and outside. They lived peacefully, quietly. They can go to Israel and work and communicate and speak the language. But now all the new generation, I mean, they haven't been outside of Gaza, so they don't speak Hebrew at all. Unlike the other ones, like all our fathers would be speaking perfect Hebrew. You know, my grandfather speaks Hebrew, all my uncles speak Hebrew, but I mean, my generation, they usually don't speak Hebrew because they don't communicate with the Israelis. They haven't been there to learn the language. You know, they have been segregated in or boxed in an area of 8 to 11 miles with 23 long miles, so where they couldn't get out of there, and the only Israelis that they know are the ones that bomb them from air, or are the ones that we see through checkpoints, basically.
When you talk about social media, how many people are even able to get computers and charge them and have all the infrastructure that you need to communicate with the outside world?
You know, it's very difficult to get materials into the Gaza Strip, and I actually... So the other day, some group of journalists, they were making a big party because they got a camera into Gaza, and it's a small camera, it's actually GoPro. They got a GoPro camera and they made a huge celebration because they got the camera inside after many months, if not years, of trying to get it into Gaza. So getting materials is pretty difficult. We don't have FedEx in Gaza, so I mean, a lot of FedEx here in this country. But I saw the other day that American Postal Service, just prior to Thanksgiving, they were able to deliver in the last 4 or 5 days about 370 million parcels in this country. In Gaza, this is not possible. People cannot get any of the things that they need. You know, there is no eBay, there is no Amazon, and that's part of the siege on Gaza. You know, you'd be very surprised even to get a small letter or a book on a birthday, and that happened through this girl who was 23. She received, she was supposed to be receiving a card and a bar of a chocolate from her uncle in California. She got it on her 26th birthday instead, 2 years later, and it was melted in chocolate. But when you look at the tracking numbers of all these different parcels, they happen actually to be delivered so quick, like anywhere else in the world, actually. You look at it and it shows delivered, but it's not delivered. It's delivered under the feet of one of the Israeli soldiers, and when they are so tired of it, they just throw it to Gaza in one day in these trucks after a year or two.
Just quickly, what are your thoughts on the BDS movement, the impact you think it's having, and maybe what inside Gaza think of it?
There is a lot of support in Gaza with the BDS. That's no doubt about that, you know. For people in Gaza, it doesn't take much of a second to think that BDS, you know, for them is something that they value. Say, because I can't be buying the bullet that kill me. That's the logic in Gaza constantly. I happen to know a lot of diplomats, a lot of diplomats that I meet who come, including officials. And one of the top officials who visited Gaza, and he had a meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, and I asked him, so how was that meeting? He said the first thing that made Netanyahu so upset and worried is BDS. He said nothing else worries him. He constantly talked for the first 45 minutes, BDS, you got to support us to end this because it's going to end Israel. BDS, BDS, BDS. So that's something which is causing a lot of trauma for even diplomats who are friends of Israel.
I was wondering how or maybe to what extent civil infrastructure is maintained or developed, and if it's not, what that means for Gaza sort of in the short, medium, or I guess long.
There is an embargo on the construction materials to get into the Gaza Strip. Do you know that wood, if you want to build a nice room hall like that to make weddings or a conference hall, wood is banned into the Gaza Strip. You can only get this thin wood, which doesn't allow you. Because Israel is actually saying that this wood could have a dual use and could be used for military purposes, which, you know, everything could be used for military purposes. I think it has taken Israel a lot of years to realize that ketchup and spaghetti are a security threat to Israel. So I think it will take a number of years before they realize that construction materials are not a threat to Israel. So a lot of the construction materials, they don't come into the Gaza Strip because of the blockade. You know, houses are not being built. Steel is not allowed into Gaza with the exception of those UN approved. And there is this mechanism that the UN has put into place, which is really, I would encourage you all to look at it. You know, it's called GRM. So Ali Bonema knows what it is because he was one of the first to pick on it. And I would encourage you to read it. I'm not going to say much about it because you'll have to make up your mind. It's just a place where basically, if you want to build a house, you have to show the GPS location of the house, and you have to show how much materials you want to build. Even if you want to build a grave. Imagine building a grave when somebody's mom died, and he wants to build a grave. You have to go to register in the municipality and say, I want to build a grave, and it's only taking 2 bags of cement. And you'd have to buy that. You would have to show the GPS location of where that grave is going to be. So it's the drones will have to specify that, and then it will be approved in the system after a week or two, and then you can build a grave eventually.
How do they get to sit or then buy it? the able, and there was the money, the cost.
The good thing that the whatever used to come via the tunnels is not the expensive iPhones. A lot of the Chinese products that make it into Gaza, that is something which you find common that people are using. And we have got some officials who are diplomats, you know, and officials who happen to be helping residents, and because they are not being checked, and then you'll find that they have 300-400 cell phones in their back of their cars that they smuggle into Gaza because they want to make money. So that's how they bring it to Gaza. That's how they bring these things. You know, you'd find people finding creative ways to bring these things into Gaza. But all comes really via Israel nowadays. So everything comes via Israel. So it doesn't take much, you know. I mean, people usually buy, if you talk about cost, for 300-400 shekels, they could buy any Samsung that connects them online. It's not a fast quality, but it does the job for them.
Continuing about social media, there have been a number of Twitter storms, thunderclaps about Gaza. And are people in Gaza hearing them or participating in them? Is it helpful?
Oh, yeah, definitely. People in Gaza, they participate in social media quite a lot. I mean, during the time when there was supposed to be a Palestinian elections, even there was a big debate. Social media was used quite a lot, and I would encourage you to read my latest article, which I wrote for the Washington Report Media Affairs, on that particular topic of using social media for debates as a new platform to end factionalization of politics in Palestine. So a lot of people use social media; they connect to social media. Remember, people were actually inspired after the so-called Arab Spring to use social media. So everybody that you would not imagine, everybody is on Facebook in Gaza. Everybody is connecting on Twitter, and everybody is using hashtags. And you know, it's becoming a common way because people, they all want to deliver the messages to the world about what's happening in Gaza. So, yeah.
Let's end the program here, and thank you so much for coming out on this cold night. And we'll be continuing to work on Gaza, so...